Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In a world full of brilliant and highly motivated people, and also full of washouts who promise far more than they can deliver, what does it take to find exactly the right talent for whatever job you have to fill? Traditional searches often start with resume scans designed to find candidates with experience doing exactly the kind of work you need. But as my guest today has learned, the work potential hires have done in the past is no guarantee that they will thrive in a new environment. And by weeding out candidates whose resumes don't seem tailor-made to the position you need to fill, you may be overlooking candidates whose future potential is far greater than past performance. George Anders is a founding writer at Bloomberg View who has written for publications including The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, The New York Times, and the Harvard Business Review. His new book is called The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. George, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
The arguments you make here are very convincing, and yet I have to tell you they are entirely counterintuitive. The best resumes don't necessarily reflect the best candidates for a particular job.
You know, when we look at resumes, we're really looking at a very stylized, sort of condensed down version of what people have done in the past. We don't learn very much about what they're going to do in the future. And there's sort of a check-the-box system where you can come up with so many traits that you want or sort of markers that things people have done. But when I talk to people about what defines your best hires, it's drive, it's motivation, it's ingenuity. A virtue that gets way too little attention in job searches is resilience, the ability to bounce back from setbacks. And I'm impressed with organizations that can go, you know what, we don't need people who are uninterrupted successes. We all are going to stumble at some point. And what we really want to do is see how people handle trouble and who's got an ability to rebuild, regroup, and kind of make the best of it versus what I call the general Custer syndrome, people who were absolutely perfect until they ended up in their last battle and then it all went to pieces.
It's a spectacular failure at that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
What's interesting about that is that most people who are looking for a job are told to do whatever they can to cover up the times in their career when they have stumbled.
Yeah, that is such a shame. I end up on the lecture circuit sometimes and I show Steve Jobs' resume at two different stages. The first is when he was trying to get Apple started, and he's a college dropout at that point. He's a guy who's been wandering around India. He's a guy with sort of a scruffy beard and a tendency not to wear shoes. I mean, you could come up with a whole lot of reasons not to hire him, but he was someone who was on the cusp of bringing the personal computer into our world. And if you sensed his energy, his passion, his grasp of what the future was going to be, you'd overlook all the other stuff. And then, of course, you come back and you get a second shot at him in the late 1990s when, you know, he's under consideration to be the next CEO of Apple when after they'd gone through a period of great management turmoil. And again, you've got someone who got fired from one of his previous jobs, who was unsuccessful by and large in starting his own computer company next. But again, he had that drive, he had that vision, he was doing amazing things at Pixar. And if you took a look at what he could do right, as opposed to just what he did wrong, you'd go, you know what, that's a guy worth taking a chance on.
So, go ahead.
You need to be willing to see the best of what people can do as opposed to just, you know, tossing out every person who's got one flaw.
And what you've described in Steve Jobs there is the classic sort of jagged resume. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is a term that I developed in the book, and it speaks to people who've got some real high points in what they do, but also some stumbles. I mean, maybe they don't have as much experience as you'd think, or a certain personality type that impressed me is people who are always trying to get to the frontier. And sometimes they're not sure which frontier they're trying to get to, so they bang around a bit. And, you know, these are people who may, you know, join the military and drop out of high school to go be a soldier for a bit and come back and try and find their identity somewhere else. And not everyone gets their footing, but a lot of people like that do. And just that passion and that hunger, it's not a smooth resume. It is jagged. It's got edges to it. But a lot of times the highs are so distinctive and so unique that they can propel someone to greatness. And over time, people either fill in their flaws or learn to work in an organization where there are other people that can help them do the things that they're just not temperamentally suited to do.
Let's talk about this. Even a candidate who has made it through the initial selection process and is impressive in an interview has not really been put to the test, because what you really need to know is how that person functions under stress and how well they would do in your company. How can we know this about people before we hire them?
So I'm a big believer in auditions. And in fact, because we're on the radio today, I'm going to ask you a question. If you're looking to bring someone into your station, I would think one of the things you could do is, you know, give them a test. You know, pretend you're interviewing someone. Pretend you're reading the news, the weather, anything. You'll get a sense of, can they do the job? And there's a big pool of jobs where it is possible to run those kind of real-life auditions on computer programming. There are a lot of ways you can say, here's a big, challenging problem. Take 3 hours, take 30 hours, take as long as you need to show us what kind of program you'd write. And those tend to get you better people than just looking for a lot of sort of Jeopardy-style questions that people can answer very fast. But in the end, all you know is you've got a good Jeopardy contestant. You don't really know whether you've got someone who can do your job.
Yeah, Facebook has been really good at creating these auditions. And in fact, they make them available even to people who aren't, strictly speaking, looking for a job.
Yeah, this is a wonderful habit of Facebook that impressed me very much. When you know, they're so big and so much a part of our lives now that we forget 4 or 5 years ago, they were a tiny little company. I mean, they were just a small startup in Northern California, maybe 20 engineers. And they were trying to hire, competing against the likes of Google and Microsoft, which had thousands of people on their payroll and, you know, dozens and dozens of recruiters. So Facebook needed some way to notice the candidates that the big guys wouldn't see. And what they did was to set up some very ingenious and amusing programming puzzles. And, you know, they're couched as story problems. So you've got someone going into a house and trying to find a cat that could be hiding in any of 30 different hiding places. And how do you develop a trail to go look for it? Well, you know what? That kind of problem isn't all that different from trying to figure out how do you keep track of everyone's photos and, you know, their likes and the rest on Facebook. But it's a story problem. It gets you in. And they would put this up on their website and say, anyone who wants to can give it a try. And they would get about 200 entries a day. You know, only about 10% of the people solved it. The rest of them, their solutions just didn't work. And within the good solvers, there was only a small minority that had solutions where you go, wow, that's the right way to do it. But then they would surface these really interesting people and invite them in for a job interview. And one of my favorite examples involved a guy named Evan Priestley, who was a high school dropout because his teachers bored him, and he went to college, and then he was a college dropout because his teachers bored him, and he kept switching majors. But it wasn't that he wasn't smart enough to complete the school. In a way, he was too smart. He had such a spirited, restless mind. And he was working in Portland, Maine, small seacoast city, and far away from Facebook, and just doodling around with computer programs on the side, and solved one of these puzzles. They loved his solution. They flew him out to Palo Alto. They gave him all the usual trick questions and interviews, and he told them, okay, here's the answer you want, but if you really took a look at your program and fixed these other things, it would work a whole lot better. And they sort of swallowed hard and said, you know what, he may not be the politest person in the world, but he's a guy we could use. And he went on to have a great career. But it's the jagged resume again. It's, you know, a high school dropout, college dropout, but he's the best programmer in Maine. You got to get him.
Even the fact that he's sort of abrasive in interviews is interesting, because there are people who don't necessarily dazzle you with personality in the interview situation, but they're not going to need to do that in the job either. They're going to need to do, you know, perform a specific function.
That's such a great point. And, you know, congeniality is absolutely crucial in sales, in customer service. But there's some other lines of work you don't absolutely need it. I mean, you know, your actuary, your auditor. Are you looking for someone who is all kinds of fun to chat with? Someone who can really work the numbers? That's a numbers job. You need someone who can get the numbers right.
Let's talk about the Army's Special Forces Unit, because they do this sort of audition thing especially well. They take candidates, all of whom seem very well qualified, and then put them into a situation where it is literally impossible to get everything right.
You described it really well, and when I was doing the research for the Rare Find, I ended up spending 2 weeks at Special Forces training, which was a real eye-opener for me. I mean, they said, you know, come on in and you'll see how we do it. So I got very little sleep that week. If the soldiers were getting up at 1 in the morning, I was getting up at 1 in the morning and, you know, sat around in swamps and watched people, you know, try and maneuver their way through. But you hit on the key point, which is they're not looking for the best marksman in the world. They're not looking for the guy who can do the most chin-ups or push-ups. I mean, you need to be fit. You need to be a competent soldier. But what they're really looking for is tenacity. So there's a fascinating drill that I watched at dawn where they will give teams of 8 soldiers a busted-up old trailer from the Vietnam era. It's a 2-wheel trailer, except one of the wheels is missing. Weighs about half a ton. And you're supposed to push it down about 3 miles of a sandy road. And that one wheel is going to stick in the sand, and you're going to have a terrible time balancing it. So they give you some tools to work with. And what do the tools consist of? You get two big cross beams, you get a bunch of lashings, you get 100 feet of rope, which is just bewildering. You go, what in the world can I do with 100 feet of rope? But that's the idea. And you try and rig up some sort of braces and support and figure out some way that, you know, you can get six or seven guys pushing on the weak side to offset the fact that there's a missing wheel. And nothing's going to work very well. There's sort of four or five designs that sort of work a little bit, but not really. And then there are a bunch that are absolutely hopeless. And what they want to do is see how people behave when they get about 100 yards down that sandy road and they realize this isn't working very well. And that's when you find out what kind of soldier someone is. Because if you do it right, you've got enough stamina and enough of a sense of team rotation and just enough of a stoicism that you go, we may not be the fastest guys out today, but we're going to get this done. And if you're too high-strung or if you're too insecure, you're tearing it apart all the time, you're going from one bad design to another, you're constantly pulling off to the side, you're screaming at each other. And the time I was watching, there was one team that kind of moved surprisingly well, there were a couple others that regrouped, and then there was one that just got lost and never made it to the finish line. And that tells you something about, you know, when those soldiers end up in a remote valley in Iraq or Afghanistan, they won't quite be pushing trailers along sandy roads, but they're going to be doing something else where there may not be a perfect solution, and you want to know the people who can figure out how to get it done somehow anyway.
And even if they don't get it done, who will sort of stay together mentally?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, special forces go in and do the work that the regular military can't. So they're going to be in situations where they'll be isolated from command for weeks at a time. They've got to figure out how to carry out their mission. And you need a lot of, you know, self-assurance and poise that you're not going to be getting, a nice friendly radio broadcast every day from the general telling you how proud he is of you. It's up to you to make it happen.
George, how do you tell the difference between an appropriate level of healthy self-confidence and an unhealthy narcissism?
You know, I spent some time with the FBI, and they have to deal with that because, you know, you think, what do you want from an FBI officer, especially in this case the hostage rescue team, which is sort of their super SWAT team. And they had a wonderful test that I would never have thought of, but it worked nicely for them. They would have candidates go out for a whole day on a very long field exercise, a lot of, you know, maneuvering through brush and the like. Then they'd come back around 6 in the evening, and now they had to prepare for a mock court case and work through a bunch of papers and files and gather their evidence. And it was a tough test of could you switch from the physical side of being an agent to the mental side. Mm-hmm. And in the course of it, there'd be six of them working in a room, and they'd walk in with a plate of fried chicken. The guys hadn't eaten the whole day. They were hungry as could be. And they'd set it down, and six people in the room, four pieces of chicken. And then they'd watch and see what would happen. And the guys who had an ego but also a sense of team, you know, an underlying element of humility, would split the chicken. And the guys who, you know, it's all about me, I'm the only person here, would grab the chicken with both hands and try and eat four pieces. And you start to see that pattern consistently, and you do need to look for it more than just once. There's no single magic test. But that's the kind of thing where you can see, okay, here's someone who's going to, you know, strong, proud, but they'll be part of a team, or here's someone who it's all about him, there's no room for anyone else, and that's going to be the kind of person that just will be corrosive to teams.
George Anders is my guest. He's a founding writer at Bloomberg View who has written for The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, The New York Times, and the Harvard Business Review. His new book is called The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. You can send an email if you'd like to join our conversation to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is George Anders. He's a founding writer at Bloomberg View and author of the new book, The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here, George, from Dormand in Dallas, who points out that Steven Spielberg was rejected by the film departments at USC and UCLA and seems to have done pretty well for himself.
You know, there's actually a couple other examples we can add to the list. Warren Buffett applied to Harvard Business School as a young man and said, you know, I think I've got a little bit of an ability as an investor and I'd love to come and get an MBA. And they said, no, you're not good enough to come to Harvard. So we went to Columbia Business School instead. And boy, if you ask Harvard one more donor that they wish they had, they let that one get away. But these kinds of examples speak to how hard it is to tell when people are just starting out their careers what they can grow and become. And I'm sure if you took a close look at, you know, Spielberg's transcript or Buffett's transcript, they might have gotten some B's where they could have gotten A's, or they might have been a little bit of shy and fumbling in the interview. And sometimes you just need to ask what can go right. You need to be able to see the potential in people as opposed to just looking for ways to knock them out.
Yeah, you remind us here that it's important to remember that for the most part, when you hire someone, you want someone who will continue to grow, not who has reached the apex of his or her abilities.
Absolutely, yeah. And that takes a certain level of confidence as a manager. One of the things that I actually closed the book on is a sense of to be really great at hiring takes a certain amount of selflessness. You need to be at peace with the idea that you might bring in people who will go higher than you ever did. And great managers have that. It's a cliche, you know, I want to be surrounded by people better than me. But I would say I've heard that come out of the mouths of, you know, 5 or 10 people for everyone who actually lives it. But the ones who do, and then you get extraordinary organizations. You just need to really believe that it's okay to have, you know, very high potential people around you.
So clearly, shaking the bushes at competing firms can make hiring talented people more expensive for everybody involved. Can you talk a little bit about some of the companies that you've met that have gone outside the industry completely to try and find new candidates?
You know, this is always interesting. I actually go all the way back to the University of Utah in the 1960s, 1970s. They basically, you know, were the incubator for everything we do in computer graphics today. The guy who set up Pixar came from there. The guy who did Adobe with Photoshop and Acrobat and all the other things, that came out of the Macintosh designer, the guy of Netscape, they all came there. And most of those were people who were rattling around in unexpected fields. Some of them had started out in physics and didn't like it. You know, there was one guy who was a jazz musician and didn't like it. So there was a willingness to go outside there. It gets harder when you go all the way up to, you know, the ranks of CEOs. And there, I would say big companies sometimes are a little too prone to hire for charisma and to bring someone from a totally different field and say, you know what, you're such a dynamic CEO, you'll be able to learn our business just fine. And there, I would sound a cautionary note that when you get all the way up to the top of an organization, when you're dealing with people in their 50s instead of people in their 20s, there's a limit to how much people can totally graft into something new and how well they can catch the rhythm of the place, too. It's always a sad thing to see of the leader without any followers, the CEO who comes in from outside and just can't get the team motivated. So they may have a million good ideas when they're in the boardroom or when they're at the whiteboard, but if they can't get other people convinced and believing in what they do, it's all going to be hopeless.
And looking for CEOs is one place where you think really intensive follow-up questioning is important. And it almost sounds like, you know, like the questions we ask political candidates. If you ask them just a couple, they've got a soundbite prepared. But if you keep digging, you can figure out what they do and don't really understand.
That's really well put. And in fact, one of the rules I got from a longtime executive recruiter was the importance of what he called the third question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you ask the first question, you get, you know, what kinds of projects do you like to work on? Well, I like to build teams. Second question, tell me some examples of teams you built. Well, you know, I built a sales team that went out and did such and such. Third question, how exactly did your sales team succeed? And then you're getting a sense of either we all worked together or I was the only person with any energy and I had to whip them into shape. And now you're starting to see who you're dealing with. And I was actually in England last week doing some events related to the book, and of of course, the English being the English, they go, doesn't this amount to almost being rude? And partly wants to go,
doesn't bother us Americans.
yeah. If you just had a little more American energy, there's no telling where you could get to. But you do need to push a little bit beyond the, you know, we're just having a happy chat, and really start to take the measure of people. And, you know, do it with a smile, do it gently, but really start to get at the heart of how do they do what they do? What do they do? Do I really know this person that you're not just making cocktail party chat. You're really trying to take stock of someone.
And you think it might be a good idea to look at resumes from the bottom up rather than the top down?
Oh, this is a wonderful habit that the folks at Google, of all places, have. That the first couple of years of Google's existence, they were determined to hire the biggest brains they could find. So they would actually ask people for their SAT scores, those old college entrance tests, into people's 30s and 40s. And I can't remember what I got.
Okay, we have, we're not hearing George Anders right now. Are you with us, George?
What's happened?
I'm sorry, we missed you for a second. You said you can't remember what you got on your
SAT.
Yeah,
nor can you think of any reason why that's going to be very relevant, that you know what you've done the last 5 or 10 years is more important. And fortunately, the Google people kind of caught their breath and said, we've gotten too caught up in grade points and scores. We're missing some really good people, and sometimes we're hiring people who must have been great students, but they're not turning out to be great engineers. Hmm. And then they got in the habit of reading resumes from the bottom up, you know, jumping down and seeing, okay, what else do you do? Are you president of your church group? Have you raised $2 million for a nonprofit? Have you done the Alaska dog sled race 3 times? Can you solve Rubik's Cube jumping out of a plane before the parachute goes off? I think they actually did get someone like that. And, you know, you aren't literally wanting people to go solve Rubik's Cube for you, but you're wanting someone who's got that kind of focus, fixation, ability to set a goal and push hard at it. And, you know, sometimes people show a lot of their identity in their projects outside of their traditional job. And if you've got someone with passion, you've got the chance to harness that passion for your line of work. If you've got people with no passion, that's going to be really hard to light them up on anything.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First on the line, we have Denise in Dallas. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I just wondered if Mr. Anders could tell me his thoughts on whether he thinks job applicants should own the content and ideas that they share with a prospective employer. The reason I ask is I was once asked to develop a lot of content and ideas with a company, and even though they said they loved my ideas, then I never heard anything back about the job, and I've always wondered.
Boy, that's a frustrating one, and I think companies need to be upfront of either we'll pay you on a trial basis and it's a work-for-hire arrangement, but the last thing you want to do is discover that you've done 4 months of volunteer work without getting anything for it. So the kinds of auditions that I described on, you know, on the computer programs, there you're solving a problem that's been solved before. You're just showing what you can do. But where you're developing original content, in situations where I've asked people to do trial stories, hiring writers, we'll pay. And the amount that you pay is small to the organization. It means a lot to the candidate. And it's also a way of saying you're serious, that if they aren't willing to pay an appropriate amount for your work, will they ever treat you right? And I have a guy who works as a speaker's agent, and he says, you know, the consequence of going out on cheap dates is you get invited to a lot more cheap dates.
I guess this goes both ways, too, because giving someone a task to complete means that you're not just one of a number of firms that they're blanketing with resumes and they're sort of hoping to see what sticks. They actually care about working for your organization.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you're asking them to make a commitment, and, you know, in some extent it's a courtship, and both sides need to treat each other well. So you need to give them your best effort, but they in turn ought to recognize what you're doing.
This all does seem to take a lot of time. Is there a good way to, I mean, you don't want to chase down too many, you know, rabbit trails. What do you do to make sure that you're investing your time wisely as you are recruiting?
So there are two ways that you can make sure this doesn't become a huge time sink. One is to simplify your search, and a lot of times people are looking for so many different overlapping or even contradictory traits. I remember hearing about one search in publishing where they were looking for a dynamic, take-charge person and also someone who could take direction from a large, established team. And, you're one or the other. And you're a hunting dog or a lap dog. Mm-hmm.
They both have their advantages, but yeah.
Yeah, you got to figure out which one you want. And but they had a large committee. They had two different factions, and they split the difference by putting in both sets of requirements. So keep it simple, and that just means doing a lot of upfront thinking of what are we really looking for. I think too often people start searches and go, oh, you know, once we start meeting some people, then we'll have a better idea. And you can do that a tiny bit, but if you don't have your feet pointed in the right direction, you're just going to walk around in circles. The other thing is you can start to automate a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in talking with people who are looking for ways that they can do simulations or video clips to get a sense of who meets customers well. And if you've ever hired in hospitality, whether it's, you know, people to work at a hotel or a restaurant or what have you, it's just frustrating to go through a bunch of candidates who have no personal presentation skills, and you go, you know what, if you're seating people at a table or checking people into a room, they're just going to be a little frightened being around you. And that's the kind of thing where we can start to do a first round of screening. We still want the key judgments to be made by people. You can't do all this by machines. But you can start to create some early filters so that, you know, if you schedule 5 interviews in a row, you're going to see 5 people where you can go, you know what, I could imagine them working, if not here, at least somewhere in this industry, as opposed to how in the world did this person even get into my office?
One thing that I know is really frustrating, George, is people who are considering a career change and may have invested a lot of time and have a lot of experience in one field and have skills that would translate. But boy, if you put your resume in online, which is the way it's often done now, and you don't have the exact keywords that they're looking for, no human being ever takes a look at your resume at all.
Yeah, and that's a really unfortunate part of the resume search process, is it becomes more a matter of kind of loading up the right magical words than really demonstrating success. I was talking with someone who said one of his best hires was a person who on their resume listed, you know, and by the way, I'd worked at a dairy for a while, and in month 4, I made a ton of cheese in one night. And the guy goes, I'm not hiring for a dairy, but anyone who could figure out how to get those machines working at triple time and keep that all from, you know, turning into cheese, they've got some kind of organizational skills that are going to be useful to me. And sure enough, he said, it turned out to be a great hire. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, you know, if you could do that, you can probably do everything we throw at you. But the mechanized searches don't tend to have a way of doing that. So, in fact, one of the things we'll find in hiring is a lot of places for all the official show of we want a lot of resumes, most of the hiring gets filled by word of mouth.
Hmm.
People say, you know, here's someone I went to school with, here's a neighbor, here's someone from my church group that I think would be good. And what you're really doing when you bypass the resume system like that is you're getting a first read on the most important thing of all, which is this our kind of person? Do we feel good about them? Is this someone who could succeed at where we work? And that informal recommendation sometimes counts for more than all of the resume searching software. So we've kind of back-engineered ourselves to a way where that sense of, you know what, here's someone who can make a ton of cheese in a night, and you know, whatever sort of assembly, project management skills you need, they're probably going to be fine for you. We bring human ingenuity back into the mix, but it doesn't happen by sorting through resumes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Matthew in Denton. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, good afternoon. So I know that most of this conversation is geared towards careers and jobs, but I'd like to offer an alternate perspective as a college student. Do you think your method of people searching should be applied to universities as well?
In terms of how they choose candidates and applicants? And who gets into the university, or on how the job hunt goes when you're graduating from university? Which way?
Actually, just being admitted into the university. Yeah, just for regular admission.
That is a fascinating area, and I have a couple examples in the book of the way admissions offices work, and you probably could do an entire book on the subject. Something that impressed me was schools where they will give each admissions officer a chance to kind of become a champion of a couple dozen candidates, and there you do get ones who go, you know, here's an unusual path into academic success, but I can see that in some of these kids' applications, because you're looking for so much more than just, you know, your best 1,500 grades and scores, that they're going to be people who stumbled a little in high school, but they have so much potential. So I remember, you know, I think Wesleyan. They had one admissions officer who came out of a small town, was kind of a bookish sort, and go, you know what, I'm looking for the kids who, you know, went to a high school of 42 people, and they were the one who was always in the library, and they might not have the kind of, you know, football captain or, big competitive stuff that you get at a larger school, but they could succeed here. And then there was another guy who was Latino and had sort of an eye for people who'd come up in hard luck urban situations. And you like to see an admissions office where there's a sense of saying there's more than one path to the top, and we've got enough people here that we can identify candidates who aren't obvious, who are even at age 16 or 17, the jagged resumes, but can see hope for them.
You know, it's interesting. Just yesterday, we had Mark Whitaker on, who is managing editor for CNN. And in his memoir, it didn't come up in the interview, but he wrote about a college classmate at Harvard who had been an urban African-American kid who had been raised in the ghetto, and at 27 ended up at Harvard because he was like stocking grocery store shelves. And someone looked at him and said, you really should go places, and helped him get into Harvard. That is a completely backward story, but it sounds like this guy made quite a success of himself.
No, that's great to hear. And in fact, in the book, I do talk about how Johns Hopkins Medicine fills their med school class. And if you've been around ambitious doctors, you know that if you get too many of the very best pre-meds all together at once, it's just going to become sort of a Lord of the Flies situation where they're so competitive and so narrowly focused that, you know, they ace all of the exams, they know the 12 nerves of the eye, but they have no idea how to talk to a patient. And the way that Hopkins deals with this is to bring in a few of what they call broken arrows. And mm-hmm. These are people who started out on a whole different career. They had one woman who was a police detective in Chicago for several years and then decided, you know what, I'm really meant to be a doctor, and did her pre-med classes at night and applied. And she might not have had the very best grades, but she was an enormously positive influence on the class and kind of kept people sane, gave them some sense of perspective. Ended up in psychiatry, and you know, there's no better person to become a good psychiatrist than someone who's worked as a city cop. They understand the twisted mind and how to bring them back on track as well as anyone.
George Anders is with us. He's a founding writer at Bloomberg View and author of the new book, The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. Welcome back to your calls at 1-800-933-5372 after the break. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author George Anders. His new book is called The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. George, you write here about the potential value of using one's own career as a template. And I had to smile at this because whenever I speak to students or something and they say, well, tell us about how you got to where you were. And I love the job I'm in. I feel like it's perfect for me, but I couldn't look back on my career and say, this is the ideal way to go about it.
So tell me a little how you did come to be a host for the program now. What sort of interesting journeys did you take along the way?
Well, I started in commercial TV and radio news, and then I went off and worked in the internet for a while. And then I switched back over here after having done some long-form interviews on the internet. So it worked beautifully, and I found what I really love to do. But I didn't know at 22 that this is what I wanted.
You know, I think that sense of discovery is really striking. And you gave the most immediate example, which is those of us who've journeyed around a bit are going to be more open to people who, you know, didn't get somewhere in a straight line but have traveled a really interesting trajectory. But let me give you a couple other examples where drawing on your own experience is helpful, too. One of the most successful baseball pitchers of the past couple of years has been Tim Lincecum at the Giants. He has two Cy Young Awards. And he's, you know, a marvel to watch as a pitcher. You know, tremendous endurance, too. He was a late pick in the 2006 baseball draft because he was short. Hmm. At least for a baseball player, he was short. He was 5'11", which, you know, I think there were seven pitchers picked before him, and they were all 6'5", 6'6". I think the shortest one was 6'3". And it was a train of thought at the time that you needed to be tall to be a starting pitcher, that you know your arm was just moving too far, and if you were small, you were going to break down. So even though he'd had a great college career, he was slow getting picked. The Giants scout who picked him happened to be 6'4", but he had pitched for the Yankees in a year when their very best pitcher was 5'9". And that ability to go, you know what, you don't have to be a giant to be very effective. It's something that he saw in his own career, you know, looking out there and going, you know what, there's a guy who's, you know, almost a head shorter than me, and yet he can play the game at a level I never can. You draw the right lessons from that, not just to find people who imitate your successes, but people who maybe have the strength that you never had and you wish you did. So I think sometimes we make hiring so antiseptic that it's all just sort of, you know, hire the people who come out as, you know, 93.1 or higher on the score and get rid of the people who come in at 92.9 or lower. And people, this isn't like buying lawnmowers. This isn't like, you know, looking for snow tires. You've got to actually get to know the people and take, you know, some insights as to what's really unique about them. And one way to do that is just draw on what you've seen.
Does any of this apply at all to the hiring we do for people, you know, just in our personal lives? Does this work if you want a contractor or a yard person or a babysitter?
You know, I'm going to be anecdotal here. We were looking for someone to take care of our roof, and we had several contractors who came in. They had nice brochures. They had good logos. They all showed up in BMWs, and they were a little on the pricey side.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked them who's going to do the work, and they said, you know, I've got a crew. I'll come by, you know, once or twice a day in my BMW, and I'll take a look, and it'll all be good.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a guy come in. His English was a little bit more fitful. He showed up in a pickup truck. He was a former, you know, roof guy himself who was just setting up his own business, but he said, I'll be here every day. I'll be on the roof. I'll be working with the guys to make sure they do the right thing. And by the way, my bid is 25% less than the other guys. We said, you know what? He's hungry. He wants to succeed. He's someone with, you know, to come back to the start of our conversation, with a trajectory that goes up, as opposed to someone who's already made it and is coasting. We also kind of like the fact we're going to save a few thousand dollars on it. But he worked out marvelously. We've recommended him to friends, and that willingness to take a chance on a guy whose brochure wasn't as tidy, who might have had a misspelling or two in there, but we're not hiring him to win a spelling bee.
Mm-hmm.
We're hiring him to take care of a roof, and I think that that willingness to be optimistic and to see people's potential can pay off.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Bruce on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I've got a question. I'm a little, I won't say confused, but I will say a little bewildered. I'd like to go to the opposite end of the spectrum, if we may.
Of course.
Where my situation is I spent the last 7 years, most recent 7 years, as an occupational safety specialist in the Middle East working with the United States military and coalition forces. My position started out in transportation and somehow metamorphosized, if you will, into the safety side of the world. I did a whole bunch of different things, and the problem that I'm running into is my resume has turned into rather an intimidating process until you start to get into the upper levels, and then they start to look at it and say, well, why don't you have this extra or that extra or something else? Basically, I'm kind of falling in between the rafters, so to speak. I don't have the CSP that comes along with a great many of the safety specialists, but at the same time, I have a massive background in the hands-on issues of building teams and helping to motivate them. I'm just trying to figure out the best way of turning out to be, as you say, a diamond in the rough that people are going to look at, other than saying, oh, gosh, this guy is way too overpowered, or, oh, this guy is, why is he here?
Well, those are some great questions. Bruce, let's see if we can get some insight for you from George.
So let me ask you, how long would it take to get the credential that's sort of the marker in the field? Because there are some fields where you need to have some initials after your name. We can argue whether that's fair or not, but that is the way they work. I mean, could you do it in a year? Could you do it in part-time in, you know, a year and a half? How long would it take?
The CSP position itself generally will take about 2 to 3 years, as my understanding goes. I have not delved that far into it.
I mean, what would be great is to find a place that goes, you know what, you're great, and we will cover your evening classes or your, you know, online work on it, and we want you to become a CSP for us. And that kind of gets you over the hurdle, and they can bring you in at perhaps a lower rate, but help you on building up your skills. What you need to do is find someone who believes in you, because when they're only getting to see your resume, you're just one piece of paper in a day with hundreds of pieces of paper. Are there conferences you can go to? Are there, you know, training, recertification, continuing education programs where you can be there, work the halls, get to know people, tell them your story? Because it sounds like the kind of hands-on experience you've had. I mean, there's no better place to learn the ins and outs of safety. I mean, you're dealing with serious stuff, and you're dealing with an organization that expects 100% reliability. So I think the moment people get 15 minutes with you, they're going to go, wow. But you just need an environment where that can happen. And I'd encourage you, keep sending out the resumes, but look for a way to get some face time with the people who could hire you.
When you were speaking with recruiters researching this book, George, I'm wondering how often they faced resistance, not from the people they were trying to hire, but from management in the company who believe in a much more traditional approach.
That is a huge issue. I was just in a forum for one of the recruiting magazines last week, and that came up again and again from the recruiters, is we're willing to be bold, we're willing to be brave and bet on some people, but we're trying to fill jobs within organizations that just want to do a connect-the-dots approach. And, you know, we talked in the beginning about being great at hiring requires selflessness and thinking about the long term. If you're just a play-it-safe manager and all you want is someone who won't blow up in the first 90 days and you don't really care how they do beyond that, then you're going to hire people who check all the boxes on paper. So, you know, I'm out on the speaking circuit. I'm talking to organizations. I get a lot of speaking invitations from this, and I'm trying to bring a more progressive attitude one company at a time, but it's hard work.
So HR folks who read the book need to get a second copy for the management that they're serving.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and so sometimes if you can get the CEO or the, you know, vice president of operations to kind of get the gospel, everything gets a whole lot easier.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bren, who wants to know how you manage and plan on multicultural diversity among internationals and the differences of social skills and how that sort of thing plays into hiring in this way.
You know, to me, it's such an obvious win. I mean, particularly if you're serving a population that's as diverse as America is. I mean, I have an example in Chapter 2 of the FBI in the 60s where it was an entirely white male workforce, and J. Edgar Hoover actually drummed some female agents out of the FBI in the 1920s and 1930s and wanted it to be an all-male workforce. Well, you know what? Women commit crimes or accessories to crimes or key witnesses, too. And if you've got a workforce that's entirely male and entirely white male, you're not going to be able to do the undercover operations you need to. You're not going to be able to interview witnesses as effectively. You're not going to be able to understand what people are almost trying to tell you but not quite putting in words because they're just too culturally different from you. So you need a CEO of an organization who's committed to that kind of diversity. We've got pretty strong laws in this country that, you know, take care of companies that just don't get the message. But I think it's a win for business, and I just hope that people can see that this will help me reach a wider base of customers. It'll help me be more firmly established in my community. It's just unfortunate that not every employer knows that yet.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Rebecca in Wichita Falls. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I had a quick question about turning this around to an employee side, how to choose a business that you think will further you quickly, what kind of questions you can ask if you're interviewing, and when you're just searching out there for what you want to do next.
So when you're on the interviewing side, you want to get a sense not just of what they do now, but where they want to go. And, you know, what are the projects that you'd love to build out the next few years? And then the follow-on question, can I help you do that? Or here's how I could help you do that. I've always found when you're dealing with a big organization, the more you can get to the growth pieces, the more fun you have. You never want to be in the part that's sort of slowly being shut down, because then you're running as fast as you can to stay where you used to be. Getting them to talk about what they always wish they could have done that they haven't done yet, kind of understand their aspirations too. And a really strong organization will have things they still want to do. If it's, you know, we just want to punch the clock and get through another day. no matter what the perks on the edge are, over time that's going to be limiting. You want to show enthusiasm. You want them to feel that you believe. And if you aren't excited at your job interview, how's it going to get better?
Mm-hmm.
But you also want them to do a little selling to you and to explain why in an industry where you could work in 6 or 8 different places, this is the best one to work. And I'm always impressed as you get to know strong companies. They don't have to be the most prestigious, the most glamorous. I mean, the people who run Embassy Suites will tell you there's no better hotel in the country, and they're not the most expensive. They don't have the thickest carpet. They don't have the most lavish buffets, but they feel for the price segment they serve that they are a standout hotel, and that kind of spirit really goes a long way. So look for that. Look for people who really are committed to excellence as opposed to, this is good enough and our customers are stuck with us, so that's what we do.
What are the most important questions to ask of someone's references? After you've met with them, you're impressed, and you want to know more.
How can I manage this person effectively? I find that, the classic thing of what are this person's weaknesses, is there any reason you wouldn't hire them? You don't get a lot back on that. I mean, they know this is basically the blackball or, disqualification question. But the how can I manage them effectively, that's when you make it safe for them to start telling you stuff. So that's when you get the, make sure you spell out what they need to do in the morning, because by the afternoon there's a good chance that they'll be drunk. Go, oh, that's good to know.
Making a note.
Yeah, that can be effective. Keeping them on a phone a while. I mean, everyone has sort of canned answers. They've been told ahead of time, you'll get a call for a reference. And the first 3 or 4 minutes, there's not... you're not going to get a lot beyond, what the candidate has prepped them on. But if they stay on longer, tell me when you first met them, what your impressions were. Get them to take you through a timeline. That way they will remember things in the course of it. I mean, it takes a little while for people to kind of open up the wrapping of their memories. And if you're kind of moving forward of what was the next project they worked on, how did they get along with people? Who were their friends? Who didn't they like? How did they handle criticism? And you're really trying to get the full dimensions, but they don't need to be brilliant questions. You do need to manage the engagement well so that they're starting to feel that they're comfortable talking to you. Give people time, and it's remarkable what they'll tell you. I mean, there's an old Lyndon Johnson quote of, every person has one thing that they're dying to tell you and one thing they're dying to hide from you. Keep the conversation going a while and you'll get both of those.
George Anders is a founding writer at Bloomberg View. He has written for publications including The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, The New York Times, and the Harvard Business Review. His new book is called The Rare Find, Spotting Exceptional Talent Before Everyone Else. George, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.